To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
You know, this guy you brought in, it seemed like he's wanting to talk first. What do you think we do?
I mean, I don't know. He seems all right, but he kind of a blowhard.
I guess we'll just play it by ear. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I mean, let's see what happens. I mean, you know, what's the worst that could happen? He ends up being like Dallas used to be?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode number 226. I'm your host, Dallas, and with me, we've got these clowns.
Wait, Dallas, I've heard this name before. Who are... Yeah, you used to be on the show with us.
It's a legend from yesteryear.
But I wanted to start one thing off. We're a transparent show. A lot of people have been asking about, you know, what happened to everybody.
Wire.
Especially Al. And, you know, it says, I miss Al. When Al does come on the show, oh, it's really good to hear Al again. Just explain, there's not really an Al. There never was an Al. And we started doing this show, or decided to do the show. I didn't feel confident doing it. But we met several people that were like comic book experts. They were really good, but they're real jerks. I've never liked any of those guys. So what Dallas did was he found an actor. And the actor is a nice guy. The actor is a Cuban. And so the one you know is Al in The Voice is the actor.
His name is Schmal.
He doesn't even like comics. And so what he does is he filters this collective of several different people. And so that's it. Anyway.
Think Mandarin in Iron Man 3. But we had the idea first with Al.
So anyway, he's busy. A couple of things happen. The collective starts realizing that they're the most popular part of the show. They start wanting to get paid. We don't make any money.
Well, I mean, I make money.
Dallas won't share the money with anybody else.
That's why I haven't been on the show for a while, because I've been spending it.
And then the guy you know as Al is a busy person. You know, he's in demand. And again, he's not making any money here. So the collective wanted to come on the show. It's not going to happen. So anyway, the only time Al comes on the show is when Dallas releases a little bit of money to him, but that's not going to happen too often.
But I have to filter it. It has to get laundered first. by the time it gets to him, he's like, should I do this or not? And then he demands more money, and it takes a little bit longer to get him back on.
We're starting to sound more and more like a crime syndicate than a podcast.
Yeah.
Just don't say that too loud. I want to thank you guys for coming out to my house. I recently moved, and it's a lot further away than it used to be. So it's especially for Don, it's really difficult for him to get here. So thanks, guys. I'll never make you drive this far out again.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
I feel like that's a lie.
I know. In a couple of weeks. Oh, you want to do a podcast? Yeah, but if you guys can come to my place.
Yeah, I had to call him three times. This is, you said so-and-so, so-and-so, but, oh, yeah, it's that way. Oh, okay. And I had to do it twice.
Oh, like, I was giving you the wrong street
names. The funniest part about all of this is the fact that my house is between here and Don's.
Yeah.
So it would have been great for Don to meet me at my house, and then the two of us come here, but I didn't think of that until I was already here.
I never thought of it until you said it. I thought, well, that would have been really easy.
I thought of it, but yeah. I was keeping it to myself.
Once again, I genius level IQ, gentlemen. But only when I want it to
It's
be.
All in your beard.
Yeah, it's all in my beard.
Has anyone been reading comics lately?
It's funny you say that, because I do want to start off with one.
I would love to start off. Ooh.
A Superman comic. Superman number one?
Brian Michael Bendis.
Yeah, Superman one.
Let's take a look at this.
Now, one thing, the reason I bring this up first is I think one of the last episodes Rook and I did, we talked about Action Comics 1000, and we talked about Superman. And I brought up that I like Superman, don't get me wrong. And when I was a kid, that was one of my favorites. But it's never really veered too much. The John Byrne, when he was doing Superman, people call it the Byrne reboot. He did kind of veer away from some things, which I thought was exciting. But Superman, basically, if you read Superman like I had, it doesn't matter when you read it, it's all kind of the same. You know, the death of Superman with Doomsday was a bit different. But anyway, Rook and I were talking, and one thing I always wondered, and part of it was because of that movie, Superman Returns, was that it?
Yeah.
You know, as everybody knows, I don't really care for superhero movies. I did go see that movie, and what happened was I was flying to San Francisco, and on the plane they always have an airport magazine, and they had an article about Superman Returns, which I had no interest in seeing. And I read about it, and basically the guy that wrote, you know, directed the movie was talking about he loved the Donner movies, as I did. And he said, basically he wanted to answer some questions. Oh, that's kind of interesting. Well, when I saw my friend in San Francisco, he started talking about it. He wanted to see it. So we went to see it at the Metreon in San Francisco at 1:30 in the morning. And whenever, I thought it was a bit over top. They showed the credits at the beginning, just like Donner's, you know, the colored lettering going up and flashing around. People in the theater was just screaming and ooh-awing and all that stuff. The movie was, I guess, well-received. I thought it was good. But what blew my mind was how when Superman showed up at the beginning, his mother was there and says, I knew that was you. An asteroid or meteor landed on Earth. And he came with it, and people complained about it. He was a super stalker, and he was kind of distant. Well, the reason why was he went back to find Krypton, realized it was gone, came back, and he was distant, but that was why. He'd been gone a long time. But
He'd been on his own a long time. And from what I gathered from the beginning of the movie, he had been on his own a long time, out in space.
Yeah.
You know, and it would be interesting to find out some of the stuff that actually happened while he was out there.
Well, that's
turning into a super creature.
Well, then, you know, when he came back, Lois Lane wrote that book about do we really need a Superman?
Yep.
You know, I mean, it was interesting, I thought. But I've always wondered about that. If Superman, you know, he can go anywhere, he's Superman. And I was thinking, what if Rook and I don't know if you even heard the episode, but what I was talking about was Superman gets his power from the yellow sun. He doesn't have to eat. He doesn't have to eat and have to go to the bathroom. And Rook and I were making this big joke, which I've always thought about, was it probably alienating from the human race because he doesn't have to stop for bathroom breaks. Think about it, work. How many times, everywhere you go, you have to have bathrooms. You know, you go to concerts, they have porta potties, you know, and there's always a line for them. But I was always thinking, what if he went into space? What if he went away and was with alien cultures? You know, whenever you go away and you come back, things are different. Anyway, the reason I bought this, I guess they have several different covers, but I saw this online, an Adams Hughes cover, and it just struck me. The logo's not on it. It's just Superman flying.
And that's
I don't think it needs a logo.
No, you know what it is.
Yeah, you know exactly what that is.
And then at the very bottom it has text that Superman 1, Bendis, Reese, Prado, Sinclair. And I saw this at Wilson's, and I thought, I bought it for the cover alone, which is something I don't do. The artwork is good. It's not always in my wheelhouse, but, I mean, I do like it.
It's colorful.
Yeah, yeah. It's strong. But I guess this is the first Brian Michael Bendis script he's done, and automatically Superman's in space. And there's alien cultures he's dealing with. Actually, this has been a bit since I've read it. They have the Donner movie, Fortress of Solitude. But it's John Jones, it's the Martian Manhunter's talking to him. And basically he's talking to him alien to alien. And I don't know, it's different than what I was always just imagining, but it seems to me it's more of a scale of Superman. It's not just the same stuff where he's in Metropolis fighting Lex Luthor and...
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's going to be interesting to see.
It looks pretty fun. It's... Yeah, I mean, I've never read a lot of Superman books, but I think over the past, 80 years or so, they've always kind of tried to maintain the status quo, especially with he's such a big, iconic character. They would do changes here and there, of course, but for the most part, it would stay the same. They'd have remixes.
Right.
They'd have Byrne, what he did, which was, I think, for the better. Brought him into kind of a more modern era. You know, but if you ever wanted to do anything exciting or too different, there were always like the Elseworlds books that a lot of creators would do, or there was that All-Star Superman, which was more of a love letter to the old Superman stuff and kind of a remix of past Superman characters. And,
well, here's something that Byrne wanted to do, and DC said no, they were letting. I think some of that stuff that they were doing in the Byrne reboot, Marv Wolfman had come up with too, I'd read. It wasn't just all John Byrne.
Wolfman was really influential in DC around that time. Yeah. See, he had done the New Titans.
But
New Titans.
What John Byrne wanted to do, instead of Superman coming to Earth as he did alone, he wanted Laura to go. And in the comic, in Byrne's reboot, he did talk to Jor-El, told Laura, says, I'm not sure, I haven't done the calculations, but I think I could put you in it too. And she says, no, just let him go, make sure it's certain he survives. But, what Byrne wanted to do was have her come pregnant. And then Kal-El, you know, her and Kal-El land. And then on the ship they find kryptonite. And she dies. And basically established it how deadly kryptonite is. Because that's where the kryptonite came off of, was Superman's ship. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But they said DC didn't want to veer too far away
too
from...
Too far.
Which, that one I understand. Certain things I kind of understand about it. But, that would have been interesting. Anyway, that's all I got.
I like it. It looks really cool. You know, you were talking about that Superman Returns movie. I kind of enjoyed it. I remember when I saw it, I was in art school at the time, and I was at like a night class. And my teacher, can't remember his name now, but he was a teacher that you had too, Rook. Anyway, he put Superman Returns on while we were working on a project. So, you know, I'd look up every now and then and watch a bit of it. So I don't recall all of it. I thought the actor, I think it's Brandon Routh, did a pretty good Superman. He reminded me of Christopher Reeve a bit, especially when he had the glasses on and did the Clark Kent persona. Yeah. He really captured that, which was neat. My favorite part about the movie were actually a couple of the trailers that came out before the movie. There was this really good...
not the movie!
But there was a memorable trailer that introduced the movie, and it got me excited about the idea of a Superman movie. And it was basically taking a little bit of the footage from the Donner Superman film, the first one, of young Superman running next to a train and just jumping really high. And over top of it, it had Marlon Brando's voice and one of his big speeches from the Superman film. And it just gave it this epic aura around it. And then it introduced Superman Returns near the end of the trailer. And that always stuck with me. I thought that was wonderful. I was so excited about seeing the movie. And, you know.
Well, you know, and Kevin Spacey was the most terrifying Lex Luthor I've ever seen.
He did a great Gene Hackman impression.
Yeah, I'm going to say that half the time I thought it was Gene Hackman. And this is uncomfortable. And
well, Kevin Spacey is uncomfortable.
Yeah, right? Well, that's it. He was horrifyingly mean. I mean, he was sadistic. And, because, you know, Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor was awesome, but, I mean, I loved him, but he never really quite took him serious, you know, like, oh, it's that, you know. And that's, again, the comics. I never really took any of the bad. You know, Lex Luthor was a criminal genius and stuff, but you know he's never going to succeed. You know, I mean, I'm talking about even in the 70s. And you know he's never going to do it. Kevin Spacey's here thinking, I think he's going to kill Superman.
Yeah.
But my favorite part of the whole movie was when Lois Lane's husband helps Superman. One problem I have is whenever you read comic books, nobody can do anything until the superhero shows up. I mean, they're basically people or sheep, you know, and I'm talking about even Superman comics that Kurt Swan did. People are helpless. And Lois Lane's husband was a good man. And I say that, you're like, Lois got married? And you're feeling for Superman, you know, like it's an imposter, but all through the movie, he was a good guy. And at the end, when Kevin Spacey's just about to kill him, Lois Lane's husband steps in and helps him, stops the whole thing, flies him out of there. I mean, all the way around, he was just a good guy. But I like the fact that a human being
steps up
and saves
something more than just cannon fodder.
Exactly.
And that movie did take some good, big, interesting chances and changes to what you would expect from a Superman movie.
Maybe
that's why it wasn't as well received.
And see, that's the problem is the purist nerds are so anti-changing anything. Mm. You know, I mean, think about the reaction in the first Spider-Man movie where he had the web shooters coming out of his arms as part of his genetic code instead of making up the actual mechanical pieces. So, I mean, changing things in the movies pisses off the super nerd culture that refuses to allow any difference in any alterations. And it's sad. You guys got to understand that they're not going to do exactly, you know, if you think you can do such a damn good job making a movie identical to your comic books that you love so much, I dare you to do it.
These characters are properties, and these film companies, they need to make money.
Absolutely.
They have to make it accessible to as many people as they can.
And with the DC movie universe and their television series and their comic books, they're creating something. Badly they're doing it, but they are creating something. They are creating the multiverse. Hmm. And they have said this mainly as a way to get out of being told, why are you casting a new actor as the Flash instead of using the Flash you have? Because the Flash in the television series is fantastic. Green Arrow in the television series is fantastic. DC does good TV. They just do bad movies. So, but they've tried to come out and proclaim that, it's multiverse. It's multiverse. Because DC was really the creator of a multiverse concept in comic books. And it's allowed them to get away with a lot of different things. So maybe what we can do is we can look at that Superman Returns movie as an Elseworld storyline. You know, so remove your purist BS of, you know, this isn't right, and start looking at these movies as Elseworld concepts and movies. And realize that DC has done this with their books for years, and you geeks have accepted it. Why can't you accept it in the movies?
Well, but sometimes some movies change, like the Donner movies. Everybody thought it was weird that the Fortress of Solitude was made out of a crystal.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was a major change because it was always a big yellow door with a giant arrow key, which I thought was awesome when I was a kid, but people now make fun of.
Back then you had to make things over the top then because there wasn't...
You needed more symbols for people to associate
it. It needed the visual...
Yeah.
Symbolism instead of the, like, I think I saw a comic one time with Superman where, like, literally there was a welcome mat in front of the Fortress of Solitude, and he rolls the mat back and there's a key under it. Well, the catch is that the key is made from, like, some super dwarf star metal or something like that, and it weighs like X amount of 1,000 pounds, and the only person that can lift that little tiny key is Superman.
Well, I guess in this day and age too, because there have been so many comic book films, and the movie watching crowd on a whole understands the way comic books, or at least, you know, superhero comic books work these days, so you can be a little more subtle in your actions. But you're absolutely right. Back in like the Donner films. Mm. The people that were going to the movies generally weren't the people that were reading comic books, so you kind of had to explain things a little easier for them to understand in movie filmmaking terms.
You know, we didn't have concepts back when Superman had the big door and the giant key of, like, biometric scanners. We didn't have those concepts. We didn't have the scientific understanding of super dense metals. That's a more understood. I mean, we had the concepts. We had some of the ideas, but they weren't so widely spread that, like, the comic book reading 12-year-olds back then could understand. Oh, you know, comic books back then were made for kids.
Yeah.
So the kid sees him pick up a giant key the size of a skyscraper. That's awesome.
Well, everything was big. Batman fought on giant typewriters, you know what I mean?
Oh,
giant
yeah.
pennies, and You know, Superman had the giant. It was for 8-year-olds in the 50s.
Yeah,
and that great Carmine Infantino cover, the house the Joker built with a big old house that was just the face of the Joker made out of bricks.
Right. A lot of that was because of, what was that guy, Bill Finger. He was the one that wrote that. Yeah. He always had the giant props. I'm going to say that I love that stuff. I mean, even now as a man close to 60, I look at that stuff and think, it was just fun.
Speaking of Bill Finger real quick, I don't know if you've seen it, Rook, but Don and I have watched on Hulu. There's a fantastic documentary all about Bill Finger. It's called Bill and Me, I think.
Really?
Yeah. It's on similar. So, and you can probably find it online, maybe on DC's website or someplace. But it's a really good documentary. Go.
What was I saying?
Fuck, I totally...
We were just talking about how things went physically, literally. Going back
to some of the things we talked about, when the Dawn of Superman movie came out with the crystal, you know, Fortress of Solitude, I was kind of surprised at that, but at the same time you see it, oh, that is awesome. I mean, you liked it.
Yeah.
There wasn't really complaints about it. You're talking about Superman Returns, it was a good movie. And I remember I came back home and I was telling a guy down here, a friend of mine, I said, it's a good movie. But then I started hearing people complaining about it. Well, saying that, I've seen it in, you know, I'm always getting cheap DVDs. When I go to, you know, one of the big box stores, they have $5 DVDs. I always see that there. I bought Spider-Man 2, but I've never bought Superman Returns. I've seen it for a dollar. I never bought it. I mean, I liked it, but I don't need to see it again. You know what I mean? And that's the other part of Spider-Man 2. When Peter Parker is on the train, you know, and Dr. Octopus has him beat, and he doesn't have his mask anymore. And he's on that torn-up train, and all the people on the train surround Peter Parker to protect him. That's the kind of stuff I like, because people step up.
Really?
I mean,
pulls at your heartstrings.
Oh, yeah. Like,
that's...
But people step up. And I mean, and I've always said this, my family moved away from our family. You know, we lived in Oklahoma. And my mom's sister was always carrying on my whole life about, how can you live somewhere where you don't have any family? Well, because the people around you step up, you know. And we always, mom said, we don't have relatives, but we do have family. But that's the thing. And those two movies are why I like them, was because somebody stepped up in it. And they weren't just sheep. What you want to say, that if you're doing a comic book, you're writing about a super guy, you know, that makes them where they save everything. But if they weren't around, people would stay, you know, step up and save the world, hopefully.
I like to think we would. I could see the three of us just showing up helping out Al because he couldn't save the world by himself.
the one image that flashes through my head when we talk, this is horrible, because is the Incredible Hulk, the scene in the Hulk movie where the guy walks up to the Hulk and he's like, I'm gonna tell you, and the Hulk just kicks him and like bounces him across the field and like bangs him into a tree. You know, that would be me. Okay, I'd be the idiot walking up.
I'll help out.
I walk up to the Hulk like, yeah, what's up, mother? Oh, never mind.
You wouldn't step up like a superhero and do it. You would use your mind and figure out how to make a tool.
Or do like a slow... You'd be the one that starts the slow clap?
I'd be like Jeff Goldblum in Independence Day. Find the signal inside the signal.
Well, that's what makes it effective, you know. And that's what I'm constantly being told all the time is, in a loving way, it says, no, buddy, make it easy. I'm the kind of person... I'm a big human being. My daughter always says there's a lot of you. And so when I have to lift something or move something, I close my eyes, grab it, and go forward, hoping I don't hurt my back. And then somebody says,
"Tell me about it."
No, dude, says, think, let's do it easy. And they'll come up, you know, we'll get a tool and do it, which is, it is the right way to do it. But that's like I said with Jeff Goldblum. He figured out a way. God, what a great movie that was. I watched that all the time.
Yeah. I love, it's a Will Smith movie. I love Will Smith. So.
Yeah, I like him, especially, and that's my favorite movie he's in, but I don't love him in everything. But
I would be.
There's other movies of his that will blow you. You ever seen the movie 9 Pounds?
No.
You got to see it. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. One of his, absolutely. Everybody talks about Pursuit of Happiness and everything like that. Yeah, good movie. Go see 9 Pounds instead.
9 pounds.
Yeah, check out
the movie. I'll look that up.
Yeah.
The beauty of this show and the internet was way, way back, we were talking on the show, and I was basically bagging on Dallas and some of the people we worked with.
Sounds
at lunch,
about right.
Yeah. At lunch, I'd walk into the break room, and they're all sitting at a table together with their phones. You were playing some doodle thing. It was an application where you doodle or something.
Like I'm sorry, it's 7 pounds. I was wrong.
7 pounds.
I knew it was a number. It was 7 pounds. But it's a great movie. 7 pounds. Like, the name is important, but not important. The movie is just fantastic.
I mean, it's two pounds, right?
Yeah. Well, it is important in the when you see the movie. It 7 pounds has significance.
But I was on one show bagging on Dallas and these guys, and the Rook brought up Surrogates, lent me the comic. Fantastic. And then he said there was a movie. Well, anyway, one day on Facebook, it was, I guess, a Saturday, and Rook just came on and says, "Hey, Surrogates, the movie's on right now. It's on." So what? And I was online, so I watched most of the movie. It was greatness. That's the beauty. So if any of you listen to the show, I'll give you Rook's number in the show notes, and then anytime you're watching something, contact him.
Or if you go to the Target bathroom stall, I think it's in there too.
Talk to me on Instagram, okay? No.
Yeah, and Rook's Instagram is on the sidebar.
Yes.
So anyway, okay, next. Don't, I know you're looking at the time, but
I was just curious.
Dallas, always worrying about the time.
I'm hungry. I just want to make some pizza.
Okay. No, you talk about that one because you're chomping at the bit.
I've got a book that I'm really excited about, and it's the first book that I've bought in a while. There's a series that I've been reading, and it doesn't come out often, but it's called X-Men Grand Design, and it's by Ed Piskor, and he's calls himself a comics auteur. You know, he writes, draws, inks, colors, all his art. You know, he's a cartoonist. And he did. He's gotten fairly famous for a book called Hip Hop Family Tree, where he kind of goes through the history of hip hop, and he'll explain everything in a kind of simplified, diluted form. And so that's kind of what he does in this book, X-Men Grand Design. And he starts from X-Men number 1 from 1963, the Stanley Jack Kirby book, and he goes. His plan is to go through the end of Chris Claremont's run, which was Uncanny X-Men number 280. So he's covering about 30 years worth of comic book history in 6 issues. Issue 3 just came out. And I have to tell you, I absolutely love it. So I grew up reading the Uncanny X-Men books, specifically the Chris Claremont stuff. So I would go to the comic shop every week with Rook, usually, and I'd find all the back issues that I was missing, whether it was printed in a book called Classic X-Men, which reprinted all the old X-Men stuff in a cheap, affordable way to get it, or I'd get all the old stuff, like the Dark Phoenix stuff and the Proteus stuff and all that John Byrne, Dave Cockrum, all the 70s and early 80s X-Men stuff. So anyway, fast forward to last year, and Ed Piskor starts releasing this book, and this is just, I feel like it was basically made just for me.
Right.
And so anyway, he's basically this book, it's he remixed a few things because when you've got 30 years of continuity and different artists and a few different writers here and there,
there might be a little bit of problems.
There's some problems. So he's taking some of the reboots, or not even reboots, but some of the stuff that they went and retconned, and he's integrating it into some of the older issues. To make everything make more sense. So you can literally read it from start to finish, and it makes sense as a long, cohesive story. And that's what I think the beauty of what Piskor did is. His art's really cool, and it's more of an indie style, I guess you could call it. And
but very purposely printed in a way to look like the old style of printing.
It's printed, so it looks like it's printed on the old newsprint paper, that old kind of grimy stuff that was always used in the 20th century for pretty much every comic book you ever bought. And it's awesome. So I've noticed from the very first issue, from the introduction of Jean Grey, Piskor kind of uses the whole Phoenix Force concept as an overarching theme, these first 3 issues. So even when he's retelling the story of the old Kirby and Lee stuff, the Arnold Drake stuff, and the Roy Thomas stuff, he's kind of slyly incorporated or foreshadowed what's going to happen with the Phoenix Force, which is pretty neat to do because it makes everything make more sense, I guess. Anyway, the art's beautiful. The dialogue, it's, you know, he's running at a breakneck pace trying to cover all these issues. So there's dialogue here and there, but for what it's worth, every time a character says something, it's in character. You know, Wolverine would totally say that, or Cyclops would totally say that. It's really fun, man. I've been loving it. When you're going through something like this really quick at a breakneck pace and you're trying to cover everything, you're going to miss some stuff. So he glosses over a couple issues here and there if it's not very important to the overall story. There was a couple things that I missed in it. The Proteus saga was covered in a couple of panels, and it was a little remixed. And that was always one of my favorite stories growing up, so I kind of missed it there. But in the overall scheme of things, I understand why he did it.
I think I still have Proteus in singles.
Yeah, I bet you I do.
Yeah.
I'm going to break into your house.
Pretty sure I do.
You know, the Proteus, when you're talking about, I remember I bought all these when I was in high school. And the Proteus thing, I loved it. I really liked the fact you get to see Maria McTaggart's husband, who...
Yeah.
That one kind of surprised me, because the way... This was a really good creative team. I mean, all of them were hitting on all cylinders. But when they showed Maria McTaggart's husband, just the first panel, John Byrne and Terry Austin drew, he really took you. I mean, and it wasn't an idealized form. It was just, it was a guy you could see was a politician.
Yeah.
And the dialogue that Claremont wrote about how she despised that man and how he used her. And then they just went undescribed because... He is the man of her dreams. And, I mean, like I said, he was a middle-aged man. But, you know, balding and everything, and had hair growing out places you don't want to. And
for as little screen time, as it were, that you got of him, you learned a lot about him, and you really felt...
And there was one
Moira's feelings towards him.
There was, like, one or two panels. It was a shop girl. A girl with those colorful socks, and she was pulled over the road complaining about she was going to be late for work, and she had a flat tire. And Proteus showed up as a policeman. And he came up and asked, "Oh, I'm glad you're here." And then he killed her. And I remember that one really got me. And John Byrne said when he was drawing it, and he had, you know, him and Chris Claremont didn't get along. And this is after he was gone. And they said, "Do you have anything nice to say to about Claremont?" And he brought that up, that when he was drawing the story and Proteus killed the girl, he said he was at the table crying. And I'm the one drawing it. But it was, the writing was so strong.
Claremont went out of his way to, in just a couple of sentences, explain that girl, what she was doing, almost her hopes and dreams, basically. And, you know, you're like, oh, this is a cool person? Are we being
introduced
to someone important?
This is interesting. Who is this? And then she's dead.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, when that whole thing ended, I remember, you know, Colossus is the one that caused him to die. And the one, you know, he kept thinking, well, I know he was bad, causing trouble, but was that right what I did? You know, there was a lot of things that happened in the Proteus thing, but I could also, when you're buying and reading it, it was what, two issues? Was it two issues?
Three.
Three?
I was going to say no.
But they were fast reads. Mm-hmm. I mean,
They were fast, but they were deep reads, too.
Yeah. We all remember it. How long ago was that, you know?
I had the classic X-Men versions of those, and in those classic X-Mens, there was always a backup story by Chris Claremont and John Bolton, and they were associated with that reprint in the first half of the issue. And so it was fun getting like these extra 7-8 pages worth of material added onto the Proteus saga to learn more about what happened, about the characters and the story.
Yeah.
But that's, I could see a way to pass over. And one thing we're talking about, back to Ed Piskor, I was with Dallas when he bought the first one. Yeah.
If you look, all the covers line up. I've got the variant here. So this is a variant cover of issue 1 that I have, but the regular issue 1 lines up with all the others, and it's like one long tapestry of characters.
And when Dallas bought this, I was surprised. Dallas got me kind of excited about it, because as we're talking about, we all love the X-Men. But when I got them, or when Dallas got it, I was looking through it, Ed Piskor is putting everything he's got into these books. And, I mean, even when you open up just the title page, he's not using any stock footage.
It's all hand-drawn stuff.
I mean, from the front cover all the way to the very end, except for the house ads, he did.
And he stepped up his game art-wise, too, because it's not easy to draw Dave Cockrum-style spaceships and those Shi'ar landscapes and those John Byrne characters, and he did a hell of a job.
Now, he's got a personal style, is what they refer to. I mean, you can tell that's Ed Piskor. Now, he has a feel for each one. I was just looking through there. It had Phoenix where they were turning her into the Black Queen. Now, he draws it a bit different than John Byrne did. I mean, she's got that Victorian age hairstyle and stuff, but the way he's drawn it is kind of like somebody you see at Hot Topic or something like that. It's kind of a... But he's not copying panels. Like, when he's telling that story, yes, he's drawing his own, but it works.
Well, and yeah, he I don't want to say update. There's a two-page spread of them playing baseball, which is one of the classic Claremont tropes, and it's nice that he spent time. But all these... In those old books, I remember you'd see Wolverine when he was out of costume. He always had, like, a cowboy hat and a jean jacket. Yeah. And I noticed Ed Piskor doesn't do that, for good or bad. Wolverine's usually, like, in a hoodie or just in jeans or something like that. And I thought that was an interesting artistic design or choice.
Yeah, but...
You know, it doesn't change the story. It doesn't change Wolverine's character.
No.
Well, I think in one of the panels he was wearing, like, a wife beater.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so, more modern style.
No, but he did that in the comics. I've seen him wearing under, you know, wife beaters.
So we grew up calling him.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah. You know where that came from? You know where that term came from for the men's undershirt? I guess?
No.
Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, is that it?
Because Marlon Brando wore an undershirt.
All comes back to Brando.
No, that's where it came from. Because men always wore, back then, you wore a regular shirt. And people were surprised they saw that movie that Marlon Brando was wearing a men's undershirt. You know, he was a working class character. And of course, you know, wife beater, that's what he was doing. You know?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But that's where the term came from. I never knew that.
You've got to well acknowledge that. We tap into a couple times every episode, man. You always
all four of us do. But Ed Piskor's artwork, there's something about it, when I say this, all respect. It just doesn't go with my limited, you know, preferences. Dallas got me excited. I was going to buy this too, and I decided not to. But I follow Ed Piskor on Facebook because of you. He's got the man doesn't take chances, and he follows things he loves, and he's done that hip hop family tree. I guess they have they have action figures and stuff, and he draws all the boxes that they're in. Yeah, it's neat. He seems like he understands how to do something and market and package
market himself. Yeah,
and but you know, he'll post pictures of him at the drawing table, and he'll post, you know, raw pages as he's working on them, which I love to see. But he does a page countdown, and I remember one point he posted, like, he's done what, 500 pages, only 433 more to go, something like that. I'm not quoting the right numbers, but and then Dallas will come on and tell me about one of the books he got. For some reason, I was thinking the guy had already done 700 issues of it. How many issues has it been?
Grand Design? 3 issues so far. Okay. Each issue is about 40, 48 pages.
Yeah, when I'm saying that, I mean, the amount of work that I just said is in these books. He took all the things he loved, made them his own, but he didn't just take panels and copy the panels that were already there. I mean, they're all... And he has them... He has a graphic way of thinking. Like, I'm looking, I didn't read the books, but I'm looking through, like, one's just a white page with a sound effect at the bottom. Yeah. Yeah.
They're
but
just
when
page
I read
right here.
That, now, when John Byrne did that in that Alpha Flight issue with Snowbird, I think it was like the third or fourth issue he did. That one.
The Snowblind issue?
Yeah. I'm just thinking, come on. I guess they made a snowstorm and all he had was word panels, and all I'm thinking is, you're late on deadline. There was nothing clever. He did the same thing with Chris Claremont and Iron Fist. With Sabretooth, the first time Sabretooth showed up. And Iron Fist and Sabretooth are fighting out in the Arctic. And then finally at one point, and Sabretooth is waiting for it, but Iron Fist is snowblind. But that one was neatly graphic, because he still drew Iron Fist. And you could, even though the rest of the panel was white with a word balloon with the character on it, you had a feel where Sabretooth was and everything was going on. That was thought to it. The Snowblind issue with in Alpha Flight, it was just a cheap deadline dodge. This one, when you're reading it, it has a feel and a rhythm. It's kind of like jazz or hip-hop. he's putting everything he's got into these books, and he doesn't even own these characters.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's I take my hat off to him. So even if you don't like Ed Pisker, follow him on Facebook. If you're on there, you'll enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and let's pass it over to Mr. Rook.
Well, there's a lot going on over here. So,
yeah, that's a big pile of books.
Yeah. So, everybody knows my favorite character of all time is Ghost Rider. So, recently I got the heads up at the comic book shop that I need to start picking up the Thanos comic because something showed up. A Ghost Rider showed up. A cosmic Ghost Rider. And it was a couple issues into it already being there, and I can't remember who it was that tipped me off, but they said you need to pick up a couple of these issues and then pick up the new one where they reveal who the writer is. So I grab it up and I start looking through it and I start reading it and everything, and here it comes. So anybody who's interested in finding this out, this big mystery about who the new Ghost Rider is in the Marvel Universe, the new cosmic Ghost Rider is, here's your chance. Turn the show off. Go get the books. Then
spoiler,
come back.
Spoiler.
It's been out for a couple months now. But going through the pages of all the people in all of the Marvel Universe, and it's a classic Marvel character. The new Ghost Rider turns out to be none other than Frank Castle.
With some sporting some long white hair and a white beard.
Frank Castle driven mad. Like, at first, reading the word bubbles and everything like that, and seeing the way that they do his word bubbles as Ghost Rider, you're like, oh, it's got to be Deadpool. Because it's the black background, red lettering, and you're like, and he's doing really weird, zany crap and saying weird crap. So you're like, oh, okay, well, Deadpool became a Ghost Rider. And then the big reveal is no, it's Frank Castle. Frank Castle's the Ghost Rider. He in this first issue of Cosmic Ghost Rider, he gives just kind of a quick little overview of soldier, dead family, war on terror, death, hell, spirit of vengeance, madness, devourer.
And it's got a picture of Galactus.
Cosmic powers, Thanos, death, and death again. So, this issue actually starts him out where Thanos Annual Number 1 ended. He's dead. But he's gone to Valhalla. So, he is hanging out in Valhalla, having fights, having a good time, getting drunk. And in walks Odin. You know, here it is, Rainbow Bridge, everything like that. In walks Odin, having a little quick conversation with him, and basically slaps his ass back on a bike, turns him back into the rider, which this rider's design is pretty neat. I mean, he's got these big shoulder pads, he's got a dome over his head, you know, for like the whole space thing, you know. It's kind of a funny little like classic like fishbowl-esque thing that he puts over his head. I mean, you can see it right here on top of this page.
Yeah, it's kind of
you know, it's
reminds me of
literally Mr. Freeze.
Yeah, or the Red Hood.
The
Red Hood, yeah.
Yeah, so it's literally a glass dome over top of his head that and, you know, that contains the flames of the rider. So it's pretty... They're doing some really neat stuff here. And the end of this issue, I gotta say, really kind of throws you off. You're like, wait a minute, you know. Again, spoiler alerts. So if you haven't read this issue, you need to go and read it. He basically goes to Titan to kill the Mad Titan as a baby.
Huh.
Stop Thanos in his tracks, stop him from doing anything. And he gives him the penance there, and damn it, you're innocent. Knocks him out, and then straps him, the baby, to his chest and rides away with him.
That's a great shot of just baby Thanos, like
baby Thanos in like a hell chain, a Ghost Rider hell chain, baby Bjorn,
yes,
thing, riding around on the Cosmic Ghost Rider's motorcycle.
I mean, this shot.
This is a hilarious. This is reminiscent of
Raising
like
Arizona.
Yeah, Raising Arizona. This reminds me of like Cable when he was running around with Hope, you know, all like Bjorned up, like you know, set up on his chest and everything. There's some really neat, you know.
It's a setup for a fun adventure with baby Thanos always strapped to him.
No. Yeah, you know, and I mean, the ridiculousness of some of the things they're doing with Ghost Rider, like with the Frank Castle Ghost Rider, because you gotta remember, there's so many Ghost Riders now. You have Johnny Blaze, Danny Kench, Robbie Raines. Now we have this cosmic screwball lunatic Frank Castle Ghost Rider, who is completely bonkers out of his damn mind. I mean, who would think to baby Bjorn Thanos and take off on a ride across the cosmos? I mean, that's the stuff of ridiculousness, you know. But you know,
but you can't turn away. It's something you want to see what happens next. So
I want to see what happens next because it looks like it's going to be a cluster F. But it's going to be a hilarious cluster F.
Yeah.
I mean,
it sounds exciting.
Well, I have a question though on this. Is this how's the timeline going? I mean, I don't mean to seem like I'm trying to figure.
See, that's
this out.
An interesting thing. Is the timeline's really kind of screwy?
Okay.
So, Cosmic Ghost Rider comes from the future.
Oh, okay.
Where the Mad King, not the Mad Titan anymore,
Ares
the
Targaryen?
Mad King. Okay. Thanos, you know, rules. He comes back to get younger Thanos and brings him forward. Yeah, so there's a lot of time things happening here. Ghost Rider has some kind of connection to cosmic time and everything like that. So there's really a lot of weirdness, you know. There's a lot of potential for even crazier weirdness, because if he's hopping through time, you know. So old Thanos sends him back to get younger Thanos. Now, Odin sends him back to get baby Thanos. So, we got a lot of weirdness going on, and it's gonna be some. This is just a very stripped down version of the things that are going on. So,
well, that makes more sense.
You know,
I was just.
It's just. There is a lot of stuff that's going to be going on with this book. In many ways, I'm kind of looking at it. It's reminiscent of what happened with Jason Aaron's run on Thor, where you had young Thor, old Thor, nowadays Thor, you know. So it's really kind of, you know, Marvel's playing with the timelines. They're not playing with the multiverse. They're playing with the timelines now. Mm. So it's some screwy stuff. It's some really screwy stuff. But I mean, it's kind of fun. I got to admit, you know, Marvel's got me on this one because they've done some out of the box thinking. Finally, you know, Marvel seems to be so stuck in their little box sometimes. So they're finally kind of breaking out of that and going, what would be stupid funny? What's the dumbest idea you have? What is the idea that you think would be absolutely ridiculous? And then everybody in the writer's room looks and goes, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. How can we make it funnier? You know, let's take it a notch further than stupid and make it stupid funny.
Cue the Benny Hill music.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's like I said, you're describing those comics we talked about before. They used to be, especially in the 70s, like the Defenders. Howard the Duck would just walk through a panel. A Man Thing would show up. I mean...
Yeah. I mean, you know, anything. I feel like reading this Cosmic Ghost Rider, I feel like anything's going to happen.
Right.
I mean, at any given moment, I almost feel like he's going to be flying through space on his motorcycle and Lobo's going to cut him off and give him the finger, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I get that this is a DC property, but, right. I mean, you know, weird crap can happen right now, I feel like. And I like that, you know. I like the unpredictability in these storylines.
That's what it is. It's unpredictable and you don't know what's going to happen next, and that's what keeps you coming back for those fun little digs and those jokes that you don't see coming.
Yeah, you know, it's some interesting stuff.
I have to say, I'm looking at the cover of this Cosmic Ghost Rider you're just talking about. I like the logo because the Ghost Rider logo, it's in the vein of the old Punisher logo.
It is in the vein of the old Punisher logo with Ghost Rider flair to it. You know, that is absolutely correct. They did some really good graphic work here, design-wise and stuff. The Rider himself, I mean, he just looks tough, you know. He's got those big spikes on him and everything, and it's just it's a cool look to all that stuff. So, like I said, it's really interesting what we're gonna see here. We're gonna be out in left field. We're gonna be out in left field, and it's gonna be some nuttiness happening here. You know? I mean, just like look at this panel, the way he walks. He walks, I mean, you can see like he's got his own theme song going in his head. The way that he draws, the way that the Ghost Rider walks, I don't know, like I have this like concept in my head of like, he's going to his own music in his head. He's nuts. And every time you see this rider, you get this impression of, the dude is bonkers. The dude has lost his damn mind. You know, the way he sits next to Thanos in this panel, kind of, you know, arms behind his back, cocked to the side, like kind of a little cuckoo, you know. So, like I said, this is going to be a fun ride, and I am in for it. I'm ready to rock.
I don't know if you're really selling this series. Do you find any excitement to it?
Sounds kind of dull, huh?
you're over the top on this.
So is this this is the number one? So
this is the number one
ongoing
series. Yep. So, but yeah, here I'll give you the read on the first page. Frank Castle was a decorated Marine, upstanding citizen when his family was killed in a mob hit. From that day on, he was a force of retribution until he died. Then he returned as the Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance. Then he became Galactus's herald. Then he became the black right hand of Thanos, Cosmic Ghost Rider. And then he died. For real.
I like it. So he's got humor in there, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even that first page. And then he died. For real.
That is a lot of fun. You got a rhythm to it.
You know.
So.
I'm seeing Ghost Rider start to pop up. I mean, we got Robbie Raines in Avengers number one.
That's another Ghost Rider?
That's another one of the Ghost Riders. Yep.
This is connected. It's the same continuity and all that.
This is in the Marvel Universe current. Okay, what's going on in Marvel right now? Okay, this is Earth's Mightiest Heroes of the Avengers number one, and this is
written by Jason Aaron.
Written by Jason Aaron, so you know that this is going to be. I think Jason Aaron is probably the driving force behind the Marvel storylines right now. He is the guy.
That's kind of like who Brian Michael Bendis was a decade ago.
Yeah, exactly. Aaron, you know, I first really started paying attention to Jason Aaron when he was writing the Thor God Butcher series, which is hands down one of the greatest storylines ever. Okay, Thor God Butcher is fantastic. So now Aaron is stepping in and starting to write and writing the Avengers. You know what? I'm in for it. You know, he's a fantastic writer. He knows what he's doing, and I think he has a love for these characters and these storylines, but he's taking them somewhere we've never seen them before. So I think Jason Aaron's going to do fantastic on this book, and I can't wait to see what he does next.
Nice.
So that's Avengers number one. Cosmic Ghost Rider, just want to say real quick, we have the writer of Don Cates, artist of Dylan Burnett. Color artist is Antonio Fabella, which Fabella, I think, worked on the Robbie Raines Ghost Rider. If I have to look back and double check that, but I think he did. So, you know, there's a great creative team behind that book as well. So, you know, Marvel seems to be stepping up, and I'm actually buying Marvel.
I was just going to say, it's nice to see you back reading Marvel stuff.
Yeah, reading Marvel excited. Books.
And keeping us abreast of what's going on.
That's ridiculous. Me reading Marvel again, you know? I mean, who would have thought that?
We've absolutely crammed this hour full of comic talk. I got to say, it was nice. We got a lot of stuff in here.
Yeah, it's been an hour, isn't it?
Where do we go from here?
Awesome.
We've got a lot more to talk about. I feel like we should save it for the next episode.
Well, let's finish this out. We would just skip a music break.
You know what, guys? I think you guys, everybody out there, can appreciate a little more comic talk and one less song. Yeah. Well, but I know Rook's got a really fun song for the next episode.
I can't wait for you guys to listen to.
I can't wait. Can I thank you guys for once again driving out here and letting me get on the show again? Don runs a tight ship, and I had to beg him to be on the show again. He's like, I don't know, Dallas, you're probably the... You know, no one really likes you, including me.
I never said that.
I guess I'll let you be on here because I'm a nice guy. No, but it's been a lot of fun. So thanks a lot, guys. I'm glad we got to talk about so much stuff, too. Everybody out there, too, thank you so much for continually supporting us and for just, you know, keeping the Facebook page alive. And just, we've been having a lot of fun. And, you know, hopefully we're going to keep doing this for years and years to come.
Yeah, at least until
Rook's beard goes below his belly button.
I think it has before. It's always changing.
Yeah, that's true.
We still got 5 minutes. I just want to say one thing. Al and I talked about a book that I found in the dollar box. I found two or three issues in the dollar box about a year ago. And it was
Velvet. Oh, that's a good one.
Velvet. Yes.
Now, the reason I got it, I like the artwork to it. I like the covers. A lot of times you start seeing painted covers and you think, well, this is nice. You open it up and it's...
garbage inside.
Well, I wouldn't say garbage. It's just the artwork that got me on the cover didn't get me on the inside. I was surprised to open it up. It was the same artist.
All the way through.
And so I bought them just for the looks. And I remember Al and I did an episode and I brought those out. Come to find out Al had some of them. And the artist is Steve Epting. Who's the writer?
Ed Brubaker.
Oh, Ed Brubaker.
Brubaker. Yeah.
Brubaker, this is during his... He was writing Criminal, which is his kind of big one. Yeah, yeah. And so I remember I picked... Years ago, I got one of those big Image Humble Bundles.
With
a bunch of free digital... Well, not free, but a bunch of digital comics that you bought for vastly reduced rate. And I got the first Velvet trade in there, and I read it and absolutely loved it.
Well... I really enjoyed those issues, and when Al and I talked about it, again, Al had some of the issues, so what I did is I gave them to him, thinking I was going to get the trade, and I was amazed when I'm reading this book, you tend to forget you're reading a book, and it kind of takes a life of its own, and this is back in the 60s, or 70s, and what surprised me is everybody smoked, and they kind of controlled time by smoking, as they used to do in the movies. That's a lost art. I'm saying that I never smoked. I'm not a big fan of smoking.
How far the butt is in? And...
Well, not just that, but when they spoke, how they had the cigarette kind of controlled time. You know, they gave you pauses. You know how they did that. I've never seen the butt thing, but maybe they did it, and I just didn't notice it.
That just meant how long the ash on the cigarette is.
But. Like I said, I liked them, but I thought, oh, I'll get the trade. Never saw the trade. I was at Comics and Stuff in Tampa. The guy has fantastic dollar boxes. And I think I got 5 or 6 of those. I think one of them was the same one I gave to Al. And the guy at the store said, oh, is that good? I said, well, I found a few books like this in the dollar box, and I liked it. And he said, yeah, I kind of want to read it. And I said, well, I'm sorry I took your books out of it. You know, do you want... Oh, don't worry, take them. I'm going to get the trade. Well... I found this at Wilson's, cheap. And I thought, all right, so I bought it. This is when it starts. It tells how she started. It's basically the woman is a secretary to the head guy of this organization, this government organization. The thing starts out with one of their top agents dead, and they're trying to find who it is, and they're framing her. Inadvertently, but all of a sudden it makes sense. I mean, when I read them, I knew that she was a former secretary. She had been an agent. It starts unfolding. It was great. It made me want to read it. Getting the trade and reading this first part, I thought, oh my, this is one of the best books I've ever read. I'm going to find the other trades. I can't recommend this high enough.
It reads like a spy movie.
Yeah, it reads like a spy movie. It has a feel for the time.
Yeah, this has some great look to it.
And Ed Brubaker's got an ear for dialogue for this style of kind of a gritty spy.
Yeah, and when you say that, that's an interesting thing because he has the ear for dialogue, but sometimes when people do that, it overpowers. Like, you notice they're trying to do something. This one, there's no trying. These guys are doing it. And when I made the comment about controlling time through smoking, it's because I lived through the 60s and 70s when everybody smoked all the time. And it's just something I remember as a kid that I hadn't seen before. It has a feel, but it doesn't pull you out of it. It just puts you in. And when I finished, I want more of this. I can't say enough about it. Reading single issues is nice. If you get them in single issues, it's fine. I got the trade because it's convenient. I'm just going to get them in trade, but it's nice to read a whole thing of them in trade. And the way that story unfolds and goes on, it's like watching a flower blossom. It's really, really something. It's like every spy book and comic book I ever read, but it's its own thing and it's got a feel, and neither one of those guys dropped their game.
And the color palette's perfect, too.
Oh, yeah, all of it.
Retains the lettering. Mood.
But there's never any time where you're thinking, well, they must be close to deadline. It stays strong the whole time. Anyway.
Well, I love this variation in the storyline when she's going through and you see the brightness of this party and everything. You get towards the end of this when she realizes the code name, and then it bumps over to years past.
Yeah.
And it's bright, it's beautiful.
Yes.
You know, even the darker pages are brighter than what came before, because it was a better time for her.
Yeah.
Rose-colored glasses.
Too. That's a good observation. Like I said, these things, they use all the tools, I guess it's Breitweiser is the one that's doing the colors. But they, everybody brought their game. Yeah.
Yes.
Elizabeth Breitweiser is the colorist, but everything on there is a storytelling device that each person is using. So, fantastic, fantastic work. Anyway.
All right. Well, we're going to call it, guys. So, thank you so much for listening to another episode. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us pretty much everywhere else. On our website, we've got everything on the sidebar. You know the drill by now. So...
Under the comics libraries online, I also added a few manga reading, which are fantastic. If you like manga, if any of you are using the site where you find comic books, feel free to send one to us and we can add it to the link.
And the site is bunchofdorks.com. Click on the Cyclops icon and then you can find all our stuff in case you didn't know.
Yes.
So, all right, guys. Thanks. We'll be back in about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So... take care of yourselves, and until then,
read more comics.